This is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And as usual, we begin our reading of the Triangle Business Journal with a look at the first inside page, the biz page. And under the heading of New Spot comes the article, Chapel Hill Chef Makes a Big Move. Yung Nae, the chef and co-owner at Fusion Fish in Chapel Hill's Meadowmont development, is moving soon to a new spot in Carrboro. Fusion Fish has a spacious location where it is, but Nae says the pandemic hit us really hard. He told his partners he plans to open his own place in Carrboro, where he will have a smaller space, but still enough room to run his popular catering business. It's really less of a headache to run a small place than a big place like this, Nae says. Nae may have a soft opening by November 15th and plans a grand opening for December the 1st. The new location at 370 East Main Street will be called Iza, that's I-Z-A, and will include a wide variety of food with some sushi and even high-end hot dogs with creative touches. It's going to be a really fun concept, he says. And under the heading of falling comes the article, COVID caused drop in tourism costs countries billions. A new study shows that COVID-19 lockdowns in the U.S. are not only posing hardships for domestic tourism cities, it's also draining billions from the countries Americans prefer to vacation. A new report from the travel insurance site Insure My Trip found the drop in American tourism in the last 6 months has already cost some countries more than $8 billion. According to the report, Italy has already lost out on $8.2 billion, followed by France at $8.1 billion. Other countries in the top five include Spain with $5.8 billion, Germany $5.7 billion, and China $4 billion. These estimates just include the first 6 months of reduced travel, resulting from travel bans and lockdowns, and don't account for the surge in cases in the fall. And under the heading of Updated comes the article, Raleigh Country Club to debut revamped Donald Ross course. Raleigh Country Club is about to reopen its golf course after a major renovation of the final course designed by legendary architect Donald Ross. Kyle Franz oversaw the restoration, which began in February. We closely followed Kyle Franz's plan and vision, McConnell Golf President and CEO John McConnell says. It's going to be better than any of us ever anticipated. The club dates to 1948, and McConnell bought it in 2003. The goal was to maintain the integrity of Ross's work while making the course a fit for the longer balls of the modern era. The course reopens to members November 6th. Brian Kittler, McConnell Vice President of Golf Operations, says the course is definitely going to be a bit more challenging. The fairway corridors are a bit wider, greens are a bit bigger, and members will have an opportunity to hit to other pin locations that previously were not available, he says. It's got a good vibe going. And under the heading of Great Run comes the article, Long-Term Carrboro Business Holds Retirement Sale. A company that's added an element of hip and fun to Carrboro is saying goodbye after a long run in the community. Scott Bertram and his wife, Audrey Townsend, opened Townsend Bertram & Company in 1988, focused on outdoor equipment and footwear. The Carr Mill Mall location saw Carrboro sprout up around it, with new restaurants and pubs and a thriving local community. But Bertram died of cancer in 2017, and Townsend, with the lease expiring, has decided to retire. store stated a going out of started a going out of business sale October 28th, and we'll have online raffles and specials until it closes November 25th. Every day was fun, Townsend told the Chapelboro website. It was sort of like having a party every day to me. I enjoyed being in the store, talking to people about their trips, families, and adventures outside. We've supported many things, and the community has supported us in many ways. And under the heading of Donut Alert, Dunkin' has a new look in Kernersville. Here at Biz, we're always keeping an eye open for developments in the world of donuts. And it turns out Dunkin' is debuting a new look in Kernersville. Dunkin', which dropped donuts from its name in 2019, will feature a modern atmosphere, a tap system serving cold beverages, and even espresso machines. Dunkin' is actually on a roll this year. The stock price slid to $39.68 back in March, but is now at more than $103 per share. And finally, from the Biz page this week, under the heading of Season of Giving, comes the article, Salvation Army Readies to Ring In a Challenging Holiday. A holiday staple in the Triangle is looking for help lending a hand. The Salvation Army of Wake County provides clothes and toys for children in the holiday season, helped by the thousands of dollars that flow through its bright red kettles. But providing for those in need is a challenge now. Major Al Newsom, area commander for Wake and Lee Counties, says the Salvation Army sent out about 50 kettles last year and will reduce that to around 35 to 40 this year. There are a number of locations that are saying they will not allow the Army in to ring because of COVID. He says it's understandable. The Army is changing how it gives out clothes and toys to the roughly 3,500 families. In the past, donors could pick a child to support off an angel tree, often located at malls. The Salvation Army also provided children with toys, aided by the Jingle Ball and other donations, and it had a vast array of gifts at its warehouse distribution center. This year, the families in need are signing up online for contactless delivery. The Salvation Army is also urging people to pick their angels online. Newsom is optimistic and has retained his staff of 82. His annual budget is generally around $5.5 million, though it dipped to about $4.9 million in the fiscal year that closed September 30. The kettles usually bring in around $450,000 each holiday season, and others giving around $4 million, meaning holiday gifts provide about a fifth of the annual revenue. Now we turn the page and we find a couple of news articles. The first is on healthcare. The article is entitled, Raleigh Provider Will Bring COVID Test to Offices. A Raleigh primary practice network is launching a new line of business targeting corporate customers as they return to work, even offering an on-site pod of medical professionals. Avance Care, that's A-V-A-N-C-E, Avance Care, recently announced the launch of its Avance Engage business line, promising to make it possible for businesses to offer safe and convenient access to top-quality health care inside the workplace. According to Ted Cole, the company's director of business development, the firm believes its options could be utilized by schools or even large residential properties. We have reimagined what health care should look like in the workplace amid the COVID-19 crisis and beyond, Cole says. As businesses begin to think about back-to-office plans, we want them to know that we are here to be a partner and ensure the well-being of employees with our on-site and near-site care options. The offering is centered around a suite of on-site or remote options for employers, including a health pod, which the company says is a primary care module staffed by a medical assistant and remote provider that provides labs and screenings in a less than 100-square-foot space. The company is also launching an advanced health center option, which it bills as customized on-site health care for employees by a provider. The company also has a back-to-work program providing on-site COVID-19 testing, including antibody, PCR, and antigen tests. Cole says Avance believes while previously only large companies could afford to have on-site healthcare infrastructure, this option gives smaller employers the ability to follow suit. With Avance Engage, employees will not have to wait long hours at the doctor's office to be seen anymore. Instead, they can simply visit a medical provider from the comfort of their office space, Cole says. Our multiple care options are an outstanding benefit for employees, as well as an excellent tool for employee recruitment and retention. And in other news, this time from the financial front, PPP forgiveness trickles along. Excuse me. Smooth but slow. It's how Brian Reed, Triangle Market President for Town Bank, describes the current state of the PPP forgiveness process. A month into launching the bank's portal, loan forgiveness applications are coming in a slow fashion. Just 4% of Town Bank's PPP lenders have submitted applications, a much more casual pace than at the onset of the program, where business owners were scrambling to apply for the SBA-backed loans. Larry Barber, CEO of Raleigh-based North State Bank, blames Congress. We're not seeing much activity on forgiveness, he says, but we would if legislation were to occur. He points to much talked-about legislation that would, if passed, provide automatic forgiveness for loans under that $150,000 threshold. Barber says clients he's talked to are waiting to submit applications in hopes the measure will someday become law. Another reason lenders are less stressed about PPP this month is the simpler forgiveness process recently announced for those with loans worth $50,000 or less. On October the 8th, the SBA released a simpler loan forgiveness application for those smaller loans, streamlining the process. Bankers say the simplified application is working as intended. We're starting to see good traction from the SBA on forgiveness, says Dogwood State Bank CEO Steve Jones, who estimates 20% of the applications submitted into the portal have already been turned around. For Town Bank, 48% of loans are in the $50,000 or below category. Reed says he's holding out hope that Congress might expand the easier forgiveness process to all loans up to $150,000, which would make up another 25%. Reed says some of his clients, particularly those in food and hospitality sector, could use another lift in the form of a second PPP. Barber agrees that a second tranche could help some, though he says he's not really seeing a clamoring for a second round. In fact, he's seeing that many of the accounts holding those initial PPP infusions still have the cash. They're still there, have been since March, Barber says. We've probably seen $100 million or so in extra deposits. A lot of people still hanging on to the money. Barber predicts the money will stay put until business owners are sure there won't be another lockdown. The thing about a government stimulus is it's not going to stimulate if people still think there's going to be a shutdown, he says. And one last article from the news page. Under the heading of travel, Southwest bets on RDU recovery with flight to Tampa. Southwest Airlines is betting on Raleigh-Durham International Airport's recovery with plans to reinstate its nonstop flight to Tampa November 23rd. And more could be coming, as CEO Gary Kelly told analysts recently, the plan was to announce more destinations. I'm happy to play offense, he said on the firm's earnings call, adding that he was happy to put idle aircraft and excess staff to work. Southwest, like all RDU's carriers, has experienced a major traffic decline since the onset of the pandemic. In addition to suspending some of its RDU routes, the Texas carrier limited capacity to enhance social distancing. Starting in December, the airline is going to unblock middle seats. Kelly said improving demand would absorb the increase in seats for sale. What we're seeing continues to be heavily leisure-oriented, he said. noting a modest pickup in bookings for Thanksgiving and Christmas. Mike Walden, an economist and professor at NC State University, says travel is improving across the board, and while the upcoming holidays will likely be subdued relative to normal, there's probably going to be an increase in travel. Now we turn the page to the healthcare page. And the big article here is AskBio lands $4 billion deal and the chance to be left alone. For nearly two decades, Jude Samulski and Sheila McHale have been working to get their gene therapies developed and onto the market, surviving through fundraising and shoestring budgets. But with as much as $4 billion now flowing into their company from Bayer, the company says it can finally just focus on the science. Asklepios Biopharmaceutical and Bayer AG announced October 26th that the German pharmaceutical giant will acquire AskBio in a deal that will provide $2 billion up front to AskBio with another $2 billion in milestones. Founded in 2001, the Research Triangle Park company is centered around Samulski's pioneering work and the use of adeno-associated virus, that's AAV, as a mechanism for gene therapy. But the road has been far from easy, with the company quietly struggling for years to make ends meet and to continue developing its pipeline, despite a lack of investor interest. With the Bayer deal, AskBio says it has the financial backing to continue its mission. "We've crossed the threshold where having a big partner that's willing to leave you alone is number one," Samulski says. "Support you financially, number two, and number three, let you innovate and follow the vision. We don't want to spend time chasing money. We want to develop drugs. Let's take advantage of this." Samulski says that ultimately the desire to focus strictly on the science is what brought them to Bayer. "When you go public, every quarter you're trying to meet those certain objectives and milestones to keep the stock up and things like that," he says. "The way this structure has been written in the agreement, we've got one shareholder, and he's got deep pockets." Samulski says he was encouraged by conversations he had with executives at Blue Rock Therapeutics, a stem cell company in Massachusetts that Bayer acquired last year, and says he believes the company will be given the space it needs to operate independently. "I'm not the kind to give up my babies really easily, and I don't feel like I've given up in this one," Samulski says. "So that should be another signal that we made the right choice because we're still in control." And for Samulski, the deal represents an end to a long path that started as a graduate student studying AAV technology. "I'm blessed in that I started the project, and I got to watch it come to fruition," he says. "This has not been only the moonshot to get there, but the ride back home, which is really spectacular when you think about it." And in other news from the healthcare page in this week's Triangle Business Journal, under the heading of Projecting, comes the article, COVID-19 Cases Could Peak After Thanksgiving. As coronavirus cases rise across the nation and North Carolina, UNC Health says its own modeling predicts a new peak soon after Thanksgiving, but this time more complicated because of flu season. In recent weeks, the state has seen its daily number of positive cases steadily rise along with hospitalizations. Dr. Linda Butler, the chief medical officer at UNC Rex Hospital, says the system's internal predictive modeling puts the next peak for hospitalizations at shortly after Thanksgiving. "But I will say that in the past, what our models have said we would have patient-wise, we've never achieved that number," she says. "We've always been below it, but we've always been prepared to take care of patients." Butler says the health system will almost certainly be prepared with the requisite equipment and medication needed. But there is risk. She cautions that while hospitals are prepared for the ongoing battle with COVID-19, a range of other health issues can always complicate the mission. Next, we turn to the real estate page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and in it we find, under the heading of Absorption Drops, the article, Triangle Office Tenants Cash In on Rising Vacancy. Office tenants around the Triangle are cashing in as landlords boost concessions amid rising vacancy and uncertainty due to the pandemic. Across the Triangle, office availability is on the rise as absorption drops amid an influx of new product and sublease space in the market. In the third quarter, vacancy rates rose to 12.1% in the Triangle year over year, even as rental rates came in at $28.8 per square foot, and year total absorption dipped to 22,482 square feet, according to a recent report by JLL. Meanwhile, sublease space continues to rise as companies embrace remote work. To compete for tenants, office landlords around the area have boosted concessions, such as Fremont's, and construction allowances in a play to keep rental rates steady, even as competition for tenants continues to rise. Tucker Shade, Executive Vice President and Co-Branch Manager at Seville's offices, Raleigh office, says tenants are glad to see the savings, and he expects more in the months to come. There's too much focus on rental rates and if they decrease. What landlords do is they offer increased concession packages first, free rent, construction allowance, moving allowance, Shade says. Landlords have already increased concession packages significantly. Concessions vary from case to case, but he says landlords have typically boosted the amount of free rent from half a month per lease year to around 1 month free per year, and sometimes more. Shade says his group expects to see rental rates dip and currently projects rates to decline until around quarter three of 2022. He said a drop in construction costs has been even more impactful as contractors compete for a shrinking number of jobs, giving tenants greater spending power for interior buildouts. Still, while an influx of office space may have led to a rise in vacancy, brokers say the new space is welcome in a market with a growing need for it. And under the heading of New Member comes the article, Raleigh Brokerage Firm Expands. Raleigh brokerage firm Lee & Associates has announced its latest expansion, bringing on entitlements and development specialist Dan Keller as its newest broker. Keller will specialize in land acquisition and disposition and will open up the ability for Lee & Associates to assist on property entitlements and development management, according to the company. Dan's market knowledge of entitlement and development is deeper than most anyone in the brokerage industry, said Moss Withers, president and principal of Lee & Associates, Raleigh-Durham. He brings another layer of talent to our growing brokerage team. Keller started his career in the print and direct marketing industry at AMC Jeep before pivoting from the corporate world into tech and internet industries. After that, he shifted into the real estate and land development sector, where he's been since. Keller was with JMM Consultants before coming to Lee & Associates. I'm excited to join Lee & Associates, as I've been familiar with their entrepreneurial style and ability to adapt to market conditions, leading to their success in meeting client demands. And under the heading of College Housing, the article, New Apartments Coming Near NC State. A new apartment complex is in the works on the edge of the NC State University campus in Raleigh, with plans calling for dozens of units. This month, Raleigh developer Michael Waves Waycan Holdings, LLC, filed plans for the flats at Gorman, calling for 37 units across a three-story building on the western edge of the NC State South Campus. The project is situated on 0.77 acres at 1128 Gorman Street, south of Western Boulevard, and by a collection of apartments and retailers. Filings with the city call for 31 one-bedroom units and 6 two-bedroom units. Altogether, the building would be 37,215 square feet. Way Can Holdings bought the property for $400,000 in 2018. And under the heading of acquired, SECU pays $22 million for nationwide office complex and deal by Crabtree Mall. Raleigh-based State Employees Credit Union has bought a large office complex near Crabtree Valley Mall as the seller moves to shrink its footprint amid the pandemic. SECU paid $22 million this month on the former Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company office complex as SECU looks to make room for its growing workforce. The property is situated on 18.8 acres at 4401 Creedmoor Road, across from J. Alexander's and near Crabtree Mall. It features 161,000 square feet of office space plus ample parking. "We've constantly been short of operations center workspace for our staff," says Mike Lord, SECU president and CEO. "This has great opportunity for growth over the course of the coming years." The purchase comes as Nationwide looks to close 5 service centers around the country amid a shift to remote work for its smaller offices. SECU's price comes in well below the property's tax-assessed value of $28.8 million, according to Wake County records. Nationwide invested $20 million in a complete renovation of the building in 2017, Lord says, including updating electrical, plumbing, HVAC, and mechanical equipment. The sale also included all furniture, cubicles, chairs, and audiovisual equipment in the building. The property will provide SECU space for over 1,000 employees, though SECU has yet to determine when it will bring workers back to the office. Next, we turn to the tech and startup page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the leading article comes under the heading of Insurance Case. The article is entitled, NC Court Delivers a Restaurant as Restaurants Get a Win. Two of the Triangle's leading restaurant groups have scored a major win against their insurer over thousands of dollars in claims tied to COVID-19. The ruling could have a ripple effect as similar cases have been filed across the nation from struggling business owners hoping to collect. Restaurateur Georgios Bakatsias had been paying thousands of dollars for business interruption insurance, but when he filed a claim after his restaurants were forced to shut down due to the pandemic, it was denied. His insurer, Cincinnati Insurance Company, said the policy exclusions in his contract meant his restaurants didn't qualify for payouts. Bakatsias' restaurants joined with others and sued. Their case is just one in a sea of similar lawsuits flooding courts across the nation, many of which are leaning toward the insurance companies. But this month, a North Carolina judge ruled Cincinnati Insurance Company must honor the firm's business interruption policies and pay out their claims. "It was a very exciting moment," Bakatsias said. A CIC spokesman says the company plans to appeal. "We continue to believe that business interruption coverage under our property policy in that case does not apply because there was no structural alteration to property," spokeswoman Betsy Ertel says. "The prevailing view by courts around the country has been that an economic loss alone doesn't qualify as direct physical damage or loss to property, which is the trigger for business interruption coverage. But it's an outcome that, according to some, could change that prevailing view." Michael Garrett, a partner and insurance attorney at Pasich LLP in California, says all that's needed for plaintiff companies to prevail in cases like this one is a reasonable interpretation in favor of coverage. "The more courts that adopt this view, that only underscores a reasonable interpretation," he says. "It doesn't matter that there might be a different interpretation. As long as our interpretation is reasonable, the insured prevail." 16 restaurants joined together in the successful complaint against CIC. Vin Rouge, Parizade, Mateo Bar and Tapas, Rosewater, Mothers and Sons, Trattoria, St. James Seafood, Lucky's Delicatessen, Bin 54, City Kitchen, Village Burger, Nasher Cafe, Local 22, Kipos Golden Fleece, Farm Table, and Gatehouse Tavern. Now we've reached the cover story for this week's Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled Paths Forward Diverge in Election. And this is a comparison of clashing views on five major issues by the opponents, Trump and Biden. And the issues are COVID-19, taxes, health care, climate change, and infrastructure. The intensity of the race for the White House and the daily deluge of accusations and tweets has overshadowed a decision with vast economic implications. President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden are both septuagenarians, but beyond their ages, they share little in common when it comes to their views on how to govern the country. Trump's pitch for re-election hinges on an economy that was driving job growth and the stock market before the pandemic hit. Biden has blasted Trump's handling of the pandemic while outlining paths to prosperity that feature more federal involvement, especially on health care. That leaves Americans, from wealthy investors to those with modest portfolios, weighing what to do next in a period of intense uncertainty. Complicating the picture is the future of the U.S. Senate, where the Republicans hold 53 seats. If the Republicans retain the Senate, the GOP could thwart Biden's efforts, just as in the years of President Barack Obama. A Democratic sweep means Biden plans could hurtle toward reality, much as the Republicans did in the first 2 years under Trump. So here's an outline on the differences between the presidential candidates on the key economic issues. First, COVID-19. Perhaps no issue has divided the candidates and the country more than the American response to the coronavirus, with Trump pushing to reopen an economy hammered by the virus, and Biden taking a more measured approach as the pandemic continues into the cooler months. The Trump administration's response hinges on Operation Warp Speed, launched May 15th, to accelerate the development of vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics. And as the election approaches, it's that Operation Warp Speed push that prompts Trump to say the corner is rounding the corner toward victory over the virus. The administration says its goal is 300 million doses of safe and effective vaccines, with the initial doses available by January. Warp Speed is a collaboration of multiple federal agencies and has provided millions of dollars for leading pharmaceutical firms such as Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, and AstraZeneca. Clinical trials typically move at gradual paces as the trials monitor the efficacy of drugs, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration carefully reviews the data for both its effectiveness and the potential for harmful side effects. Given the scope of the pandemic, Warp Speed has sought to accelerate those timelines, but where vaccines and therapeutics come available remains uncertain as the results of clinical trials have varied. So, vaccines and therapeutics are likely months away, and that raises the question of how the country should respond until the vaccines and therapeutics are available. Officially, Trump's plan calls for a three-phased approach to guide state and local officials on when to reopen. That includes a downward trajectory over a 14-day period on documented cases or positive tests, and a robust testing program in place for at-risk healthcare workers. The plan expects states to be able to supply enough personal protective equipment and to have enough ICU capacity to handle surges, and it expects states to closely monitor conditions and cut back on reopening plans as surges become severe. But Trump's freewheeling style often veers from those official statements on the White House website, urging states such as North Carolina to reopen business and schools, and slamming Dr. Anthony Fauci in a campaign call. Biden, meanwhile, has accused Trump of handling the pandemic poorly and says he will emphasize widespread free testing and the elimination of all cost barriers for treatment. Biden has criticized Trump's questioning of federal health agencies and officials and says the decision on the virus will be guided more by public health officials and scientists. Now, second issue of health care. The future of the Affordable Care Act looms over the election, but at the most basic level, Trump and Biden have vastly different views on the government's role in American health care. Trump wants to reduce it, while Biden wants to expand it. At the heart of this is the ACA, signed into law in 2010 by President Barack Obama, with Biden standing by and applauding. The GOP efforts at a skinny repeal of the ACA failed in July 2017, when the late Senator John McCain voted no on a proposal that he felt wouldn't do enough to increase competition, reduce costs, and improve care. So, Republicans moved to the courts, and the Supreme Court on November the 10th will hear a challenge to the ACA that could limit or even overturn it. A decision is expected by June. The court had ruled in 2012 that the ACA was appropriate because it relied on a tax. The Trump administration is asking the court to overturn the entire ACA, and Trump promises a better, cheaper health care bill will follow. Trump wants to eliminate Obamacare and force insurance companies to compete for customers and thus drive down prices. But a fact check by the Associated Press says the plans would be cheaper because they skimp on benefits such as maternity or prescription drug coverage. Under the ACA, insurers can't deny coverage or charge more because of pre-existing conditions. In an executive order in September, Trump committed to protecting those with pre-existing conditions. Biden, by contrast, wants to build on the ACA, most significantly with a public health insurance option. The goal of the public option would be to negotiate lower prices from health care providers and reduce costs for patients. Also, Biden says the public option would help small businesses provide far better health care for their employees. Critics of Biden's proposal say taxes and higher premiums on those outside the public option would essentially underwrite the plan, putting an unfair burden on those trying to compete with the public option. Biden also wants to lower Medicare eligibility from 65 to 60. And significantly, many states, such as North Carolina, have not agreed to the expansion of Medicaid, so Biden wants the public option to provide coverage for people impacted in those states. Our next issue, climate change. Trump has given conflicting statements on whether he believes human efforts are causing the world's climate to shift, but his actions related to that have been clear, guided by an underlying concern that efforts to combat climate change cost Americans jobs. In 2017, Trump pulled the United States out of the Paris Agreement, which seeks to build an international consensus toward limiting the rise of the global temperature. Nearly 200 countries signed on to the agreement in 2015. Trump ended U.S. participation and pointed to onerous energy restrictions that could cost America as much as 2.7 million lost jobs by 2025. In 2018, the Trump administration moved to replace Obama's Clean Power Plan. The new proposal, the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, gave the states more authority in regulating greenhouse gas emissions from a coal-fired plant. Under Obama, the federal government has sought to move toward renewable energy. The two candidates have starkly different views on the Green New Deal, introduced by Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and Senator Edward J. Markey of Massachusetts, that calls on a move away from fossil fuels and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Trump says the Green New Deal will kill millions of jobs, it'll crush the dreams of the poorest Americans, and disproportionately harm minority communities. I will not stand for it. Biden's campaign calls the Green New Deal a crucial framework for how to combat climate change and says the U.S. should fully adopt a clean energy future. Biden is calling for more investment in clean energy and climate research and innovation. Biden says his administration will rejoin the Paris Agreement. Our next issue, taxes. Those sweeping Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 revamped the American tax code and lowered the corporate tax rate permanently to 21%. The bill kept the 7 rates for individual filers, but generally lowered those rates. For example, the 28% tax bracket fell to 24%. The law also set the standard deduction at $24,000 for married couples and $12,000 for single filers. The changes also accelerated the federal deficit, a problem escalated by the pandemic. The U.S. deficit for the 2020 budget year that ended September the 30th was a record $3.1 trillion, far more than the $984 million the previous year. The CARES Act, committing roughly $2.2 trillion to fight the impact of COVID-19, heightened the growth of the federal deficit. Trump, before the Republican National Convention, vowed to cut taxes to boost take-home pay, establish Made in America tax credits, and to expand the opportunity zones that were a part of the 2017 Tax Act. Biden, meanwhile, would raise taxes on those who earn more than $400,000 from 37% to 39.4%, as well as applying the 12.4% Social Security tax. He would also seek to raise the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. On long-term capital gains and dividends, Biden seeks to go from the current law of 20% to 39.6% on taxable income over $1 million. Biden also proposes a 15% minimum tax on corporate book income of $100 million and higher. But it's important to note that there's a reason the tax code rarely is overhauled. If there's a split in power between the White House and Congress, any major changes are unlikely. Even if the Democrats grab control of both the executive and legislative branches, change rarely happens quickly. Even the GOP, after the 2016 elections, took until December the 22nd of 2017 to get the changes passed. The uncertainty of the election and the potential for some parts of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to sunset is why wealth advisors are urging clients to be proactive about wealth transfer planning. And for wealthy investors in real estate, Biden's proposals would be particularly impactful, eliminating the like-kind 1031 exchange that allows capital gains taxes to be deferred. And finally, the topic of infrastructure. In 2016, Hillary Clinton and Trump agreed on few issues, but both agreed the U.S. needed to invest in its infrastructure. Clinton proposed a 5-year, $275 billion investment in infrastructure, and candidate Trump promised to invest $1 trillion over 10 years. After winning the election, Trump promised on November the 9th, 2016, to fix our inner cities, rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, and hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it. The needs were clear. On March 9, 2017, the American Society of Civil Engineers released its once every 4 years report that gave the country a D-plus for infrastructure. The group estimated that an investment of $4.59 trillion was needed in infrastructure. But little consensus emerged in Washington on exactly what to do and how to pay for it, as no major infrastructure packages emerged. In February 2018, Trump presented a $1.5 trillion plan that would include $2 billion in federal dollars. But the plan floundered on concerns about where the federal cash would come from and the cost to the states. In February, before the impact of the coronavirus, Trump proposed a $1 billion infrastructure plan fully sourced with federal spending. On October 1st, Trump signed a 1-year extension of the highway bill to keep the Highway Trust Fund from running out of money. That effectively kicks key decisions on infrastructure into next year. Biden's plans call for $2 trillion in accelerated investment, with more emphasis on the clean energy sector and investment in union jobs to expand the middle class. The plan calls for support for 1 million new jobs in the auto industry, flexible federal investments in public transportation in American cities. And frequent listeners to this program will know that right after covering the cover story, we usually have an article called Executive Voice. And so this week, we read about David Fitch. You also probably recall that there's a Q&A associated with this, and so I'll read a little bit of background, and then we'll look at the questions and David Fitch's answers. The pandemic has had a devastating impact on wide swaths of the American economy, but some have been more resilient than others, and that's been the case with venerable Fitch Lumber and Hardware in Carrboro. The company began in Mebane in 1907 and opened a shop in Carrboro in 1923 to support a building boom at UNC Chapel Hill. As Orange County has grown, so has Fitch Lumber, and you can see its name on products across the market as buildings continue to rise. Now, the company is President David Fitch. Now leading the company is President David Fitch, one of many family members involved in the business. And even the current crisis, Fitch Lumber has persevered as homeowners add projects and building continues across the triangle. So now for the Q&A. How many employees does Fitch Lumber have? 36. Do you still have anything that harkens back to your early days? We were originally pretty much a planer mill coal department. We wanted to come into Chapel Hill, but for some reason the town and or university wouldn't let us, so we pulled up just short in Carrboro along the railroad tracks. We still have a bunch of old stuff, our original cashier machine, our nail weight scales and artifacts people bring in with our name on it, and several old pictures of what Carrboro used to look like in the 1930s and 40s and so on. My dad tells stories of our previous generations selling lumber all day and then delivering by horse and trailers at night. So how's the pandemic affected your business? I feel like we had to rewrite our HR manual every week during March and April when the pandemic began. We shut the doors to the public, but continued to operate our pickup and delivery service until we invited our customers back inside in June. Homeowners went on a tear after sitting at home for a month. It was DIY Central. We sold more treated wood in April and May than I can ever remember. Our custom wood shop, a.k.a. the chopping block, built more garden boxes, chicken coops, and play structures than we could handle. Oddly enough, construction hasn't batted an eye during this pandemic. In fact, it's increased. We're still playing catch-up. One concern in the building industry is the price of lumber. How has that affected the building industry in the Carrboro Chapel Hill area? Huge mill shutdowns due to COVID and a large uptick in DIY demand was the gas on the fire. Eventually, the pot boiled over and prices kept soaring as the immense lack of supply couldn't keep up. Southern yellow pine and spruce pine and fire lumber literally doubled from April to September. But people keep building. If you already have footings dug and crews lined up, you've got to go on with it to stay afloat. Prices have flattened out now and are starting to slowly creep back down, but it won't go back to near to what it was. There's still too much pent-up demand. Finally, one more question and answer. The Fitch family has at least 5 members directly involved in the company. Tell us about balancing work and family life. Pretty much all my family members have worked in the business at some point. My 3 brothers, parents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and soon to be our kids. I'd be lying to you if I said there's hard line separation between work and life. Work is life. The company is my life and my family. It never ends. Owning your own family business is both a blessing and a curse, but I feel very blessed, though, very. Of course, there are some struggles, but we all get along pretty well. The important thing is to be dead honest with each other. Don't let problems stew, and learn that it's okay that we can agree to disagree. Now we come to the viewpoint page of this week's TBJ. There's a guest columnist here, as usual. Her name is Jenny Schutz. Schutz is a fellow at Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. Her column is entitled, How Many Can't Pay Rent? That's a tricky question. 7 months into the COVID-19 pandemic, many households are running on fumes, financially speaking. The U.S. has 11 million fewer jobs than it did in February, with income losses hitting hardest among low-wage workers. Since April, housing advocates and scholars have been predicting an unprecedented number of evictions as renters fall behind on monthly payments. How many renters are in financial trouble? How many will face eviction when current protections end? The truth is, we don't have great real-time data to help answer those questions. Policymakers and the public receive high-frequency updates on labor markets, including weekly unemployment insurance claims and monthly job numbers. But federal statistical agencies don't publish real-time data on housing distress, especially for renters. To help fill this gap, in April of 2020, the Census Bureau launched a Household Pulse survey. This weekly survey asked people about job losses and economic distress, including two key housing questions. One question is backward-looking. Did you pay your rent this month? Respondents can answer yes, no, or deferred. For example, homeowners who have received mortgage forbearance under the CARES Act are allowed to defer payments for up to 1 year. The second question is forward-looking. How confident are you that you'll be able to pay your next rent or mortgage payment on time? And respondents can select one of four answers: no confidence, slight, moderate, or high confidence. The question for policymakers is, do the forward-looking responses about the ability to pay rent translate into actual behavior? And can this data be used to reliably estimate the number of people who will miss upcoming payments? A new paper from Jeff Larimore and Aaron Trolin sheds light on how responses from the Household Pulse survey can be used to forecast how many households will miss rent payments, and a caution on how not to use the data. The author's key insight is that every household has some underlying probability of paying or not paying rent the next month. By comparing responses for the same household over time, they can calculate the probability of paying rent for each group of households expressing similar levels of confidence in the forward-looking question. Their analysis shows that while answers to the forward-looking question are strongly correlated with actual rent payment, the correlation is by no means perfect. And the other article from the Viewpoint page, of course, is the editor's notebook, and it's entitled, Ask BioDeal Reflects Area's Scientific Strengths and Future. Anyone who's been reading my column over the years knows that I love writing about deals, M&As, buying, selling, splitting, anything that allows me to look under the hood. So on October the 26th, when German pharma giant Bayer AG announced it was buying the Research Triangle Park-based boutique gene therapy firm Asklepios Biopharmaceutical for as much as $4 billion, the first thing I thought of was, here we go again. We will lose another promising pharma to a much larger, out-of-date, out-of-state entity, denying the area a chance to house a homegrown company and its corporate headquarters. But after reading and talking to people in the industry, I came away thinking this deal might be slightly different than, say, the Salix Pharmaceuticals deal, in which Bausch Health, then known as Valiant Pharmaceuticals, bought Salix, the Carolina Power and Light deal, in which Duke bought CPNL, or Quintiles deal, in which Legacy IMS Health bought Quintiles and changed the combined firm's name to IQVIA. In those deals, the influence that came with the senior executives stationed in our area were all stripped off within months of the sale. The region lost valuable dollars tied to suppliers, vendors, and the nonprofit sector. For an area already having trouble recruiting large, successful companies to move their corporate headquarters, those were long-lasting blows. Just ask any economic developer in the area. But the Bayer AG Ask Bio deal looks more like the $34 billion IBM Red Hat deal. IBM knew what it was getting by buying Red Hat. The leadership in New York knew that Raleigh's open-source cloud products company can't simply be swallowed into Big Blue's ginormous infrastructure and be placed into its cluttered assembly line of thought and innovation. Red Hat was given room to breathe, and Red Hat has delivered. IBM generated more than $2.3 billion in net cash during the latest quarter. Operating income was up some 18%. And now Big Blue has more than $14 billion of cash in hand. That's enough gunpowder to buy companies and start new ventures to complement its existing services. Of course, not all those gains are attributable to Red Hat's cloud business, but Jim Whitehurst's old company is definitely making its presence felt. Whitehurst now is the president of Big Blue. If Bayer AG knows a thing about letting companies breathe, it will let AskBio do just that. During the announcement, Bayer said it will pay AskBio $2 billion up front and as much as another $2 billion if the company hits certain milestones. For that to happen, AskBio co-founder Judd Smolsky must be allowed to continue his work on adeno-associated viruses that act as an agent inside the body to replace a defective gene with a healthy gene. To Bayer, this could be the path to improve its pipeline of drugs, something the company's financial analysts have been worried about for a while. AskBio's other co-founder, Sheila McHale, becomes the second woman in the triangle in the past 5 years to have a billion-dollar-plus exit following the sale of Cindy Eckert's female Viagra-like drug, Adderall. Smolsky is a quintessential type of an RTP-based scientist who goes to work every day at the lab, tries to change the world with science and research. We're so lucky to have thousands of them in our backyard. Let's make sure we foster them, nurture them, and as a community, try to open doors for them, because when they succeed, the entire region benefits. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. If you have any comments or questions, please call us, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long till next time. Thank you.